History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold as long as people like you and me are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest the time to patiently listen as memories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you happened to catch last week's episode, you heard a 100-year-old veteran named Bill DeGeneres talk about following in his father's footsteps and enlisting in the Navy in 1941, several months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. But there was a lot more to Bill's story that wouldn't fit into our show last week, so we took that rare step of asking you to wait another week for the rest of the story. Among the things we're going to hear today are Bill's perspective on the end of World War II and what might have happened to him if the atomic bomb had not been dropped. We'll hear his memories of a good friend who did not come home from the war, what Bill experienced on his honor flight to Washington, D.C., and even the first story I can ever remember hearing from a World War II veteran, and I've heard a lot, about drunken frogs. A lot to look forward to today. If you missed the first part of Bill's interview last week, you can access that online at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll also find photos of Bill then and now, and even some of the remarkable artwork that he's produced in his life, including one piece that's part of the Smithsonian collection. We'll work into the rest of his story with a unique element of it that some of you caught last week. It was fairly rare for father and son to both be serving in the war. The odds were even longer for connecting with your dad in the Pacific, but that's what happened when Navy Corpsman Bill DeGeneres learned that his dad was on Tulagi when Bill was in the vicinity with the Marines.
I got permission to take an inter-island traffic over there. I've met him and stayed with him a couple of times, watched the movies on his boat while we're there. It was very pleasant, you know. And then we got, I don't know how long we were there on Guadalcanal, maybe, a few weeks or months or so. And we got orders that we were going to move up the slot, what they call it, to an island up there. And at the time, I didn't know who it was. But I told my dad when I wrote him a letter. We're going to be moving out, and soon. And anyway, because we were getting all ready, and so he invited me to come see if I could get aboard his ship and go with him up there. You know, I didn't know it was going to be an invasion or we were just moving. So I asked my captain about that, you know, and he said, sure, if you want to go over there, go ahead with him, you know, take a little boat and go. Everything was pretty loose in those days. So I went aboard his ship, and a day later, we all got together and his ships got together, and there was LSTs and troop ships, I don't know, there was a few, running parallel to go up the slot. We left in the evening, and it was, it doesn't take too long to go up through there. In the middle of the night or early morning, still dark, we got general quarters. Everybody had to go out on deck. We all go out on deck and keep sailing, and I was on his ship there, you know. And pretty soon we hear this planes flying, you know, around. This plane went past our fantail and went across because there was two lines of ships going up. About that time, the LST across the way, maybe 100 yards or more, opened fire all along. It looked like a blowtorch coming out. It hit that plane and knocked it down, right? Just, you know, not too far from it. Kaploop. It was pretty bad because there was another plane. It, It was a torpedo plane came by and dropped behind this guy when he was shot down. There was another one of them. They said they were float planes. I couldn't see them. I just saw dark things coming over, and the flames from the rear, from the motors. You know, this second plane, it was fired on, but he had already dropped his torpedo, and he didn't get knocked down, but it hit one of Dad's ships, same type of ship. A four-stacker, and I saw that thing just blow up, and it was pretty bad. Yeah, there was a few of them. I guess a lot of them on that ship were killed. And my dad said, "Yeah, it wasn't his ship; it was one of his ships that was knocked down." So they lost a lot of that personnel. So and then after that, we went on up into Bougainville, and Dad got a shore boat, picked me up, and take me to where I was. To be bivouacked on Bougainville, down the southern part of Bougainville. Mm-hmm. That's it for that day.
I can see why you haven't forgotten that day. That sounds pretty memorable. And now this is going to be just a series of islands that you're spending the next couple years of your life on. And your job there is to take care of Marines if they're wounded, right?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you have to start doing that?
Well, not for a while yet. After Bougainville, we came back to Guadalcanal, and we weren't there for more than a few weeks. And they said, we're getting aboard ship, we're going on maneuvers. So the whole bunch of us, part of the division, got on two or three ships, had to climb the rope ladder to get up on that. What an experience that is. You know, you look down, that the water's a long way down below. So you learn to grab the vertical rope and don't put your hands on the horizontal rope because somebody's going to step on you. You know. But anyway, we went to a couple of islands out while we were out. They said it was in Iwetok or Kwajalein, and we went ashore and they put some beer in a couple of shore boats, and we had a beer fest on the beach there, and it was hot. And there was a funny thing that happened. One of the guys found there's a certain kind of crab in those islands. It's got claws like you wouldn't believe, and it's a big, big crab. Anyway, he found a crab and he stuck his rifle down there to poke the crab, and the crab grabbed the sights on his rifle and bent the sights. Oh, those claws were like 6 or 8 inches long. So it wasn't bad, but he grabbed him, just pushed him. So he got rid of that. But that was a nice experience. You know, he had a break in routine and stuff. We got to go out and swim that day and enjoy a little food and the beer that they sent with for us too. So we got back a warship after that, and well, I guess we visited another island. They were, from what I can remember, they were just planning maneuvers or planning what to do in case of an invasion. That's all I could see. All we did was get aboard and sit and wait for something to happen. You know, back to Pinochle. You know, so anyway, then we went back to Guadalcanal, waited for something to happen. Then we loaded up. After that, wasn't more than 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. We load up and several ships, and we took off. Where we were going to go, we don't know. They wouldn't tell us, you know. We just going, and there was several troop ships. I would say at least 4 or 5, and so it was quite a trip from, I don't know how long, from there to the Marianas. Get your gear together. We're going ashore. So we're getting ready, and all the shore boats were circling to pick us up. And so they came one by one, pick us up, and down the rope ladder we go again and get in the boats. And we went ashore, and as we're going ashore, we saw a lot of cannon fire. So anyway, we went into the beach, and ahead of me, there was a line of LCPBs that went into the beach first, and they were fired upon. I thought, well, we're going to get in that. But by the time we got in there, a lot of it had already moved inland. They pushed them inland, and there was mountain work that they were having to go up over and around. And about that time, there was a lot of aircraft coming in, and they were shooting missiles into the refetments or the defensive places that the Japs had. So I watched a lot of that, and there was no fire by the time I got there. It was already moved inland, so we all had to dig foxholes waiting for the next thing to happen, which not much of it happened. It all went inland. So what they did, they set up the aid station, and I worked in the aid station for 2 or 3 days, and then they put me in grave registrations because I had the dental experience, and they needed somebody to identify undefiable personnel, which I worked at for a week or so until they used me for other things after that.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who had that kind of duty. Some of them only dealt with a few casualties, and some of them thousands. But how hard was that to carry out that duty, knowing this is a guy that could have been you?
Well, not fun. Not fun at all. And the part about it was, that was about a week after we landed. They put me on registration, grave registration, where they were digging the grave sites and collecting body bags for them. And they were setting that all up, and I had half a dozen or a dozen unidentifiable bodies, and I had to chart their teeth, which would be to the best of my ability. The bodies were in not good shape most of the time, and it was kind of gruesome and smelly, of course. You know, it was not fun. And so that's what I did. And I found out one of my buddies had been killed ahead of me. His name, Herb Clark, was a good friend of mine. And I didn't see his body or anything, but I found out it was him, and he'd already been buried. And in fact, he was buried before the graveyard was established, and they had to go out and dig him up and bring him up, and they knew who he was, and so I didn't have to identify him. In fact, I wrote a letter to his wife. I got a permission to do that, and I sent a letter of condolences, best as I could do, to help his wife understand that he did have friends out there. Later on, after the war, she contacted me, and I went out and met his wife and his mother and father. They, I understand later, they had his body reinterred from Guam and brought to the States, and he was reinterred in and around the Veterans Cemetery there in Westwood.
Yeah. I'll ask you more about Herb Clark, because that really underscores all of this. So this is Guam, where you came ashore, and you're seeing what can happen, and then you lose one of your friends. You said a real good friend, Herb Clark. Is there something that you process yourself when that happens? That do you think any more about the possibility that you could be next?
Oh, I always thought that. I always was on the island. In fact, after my stint in the graveyard, they filled it up. They needed a corpsman for other duties. They put me on with a group of Marines every 2 or 3 days with patrol duty of the island. In fact, because at several times they had snipe attacks, there was still a lot of Japs all by themselves all over the island. As far as I remember, Guam was not a major target. It was an island, from what I found out later, for the elite of the Japanese for relaxation and comfort. They had a comfort island anyway. And there wasn't a great setup of resistance there. The biggest setup was over on Saipan and Tinian. They had a lot of work there to do. The Marines had a tough time. And so I had this call for every couple of days to go on patrol duty. And we had a couple of experiences of finding a sniper. And one time it was two snipers in the same place. And incidentally, we had a flamethrower with us. This was all on a little peninsula off the island called Arodi Peninsula. These snipers were sitting there, and there was a road going back and forth from the main town to different places. Main town was Aganya. So they wanted somebody to find out what's happening with the snipers out there. We went out there and located them. They saw us come in, sniped at us. And nobody got hit, but they moved the flamethrower up real close, and he cut loose and took care of that business right there. So that was pretty exciting. So there wasn't much left of them after that, you know. Oh. But that was just about all I did from then on until the island was secured pretty early, actually. I ran into a few of my friends. I had another friend who was a Marine, ran into a couple of times on the island. His group were sitting out. They were machine gunners. They set up a nest. And whenever they got any kind of information, there may be an attack or anything like that, they set up and try to stop it, you know. So I ran into him several times, and that's what he did. But from then on, there's not much else to do.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear how Bill DeGeneres and his friends spent some of that time on Guam, the first story I've ever heard in which rubbing alcohol turned into ribbit alcohol. No amphibians were harmed in the recording of this episode. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our fascinating interview with 100-year-old Navy veteran Bill DeGeneres. As a corpsman serving with the Marines in the Pacific, he knew all about amphibious assault, but he would also get a little education in amphibian animals on Guam.
They sent me out one time on an aid station not too far from where there was a group of Marines. They were doing just that, trying to stop any Japanese invasion. And me and another guy sat out there. They gave us a Coleman lantern, and we was in a pyramidable tent. Maybe not a lot of people know it, but Guam has got a lot of frogs on it. We sat out there with the lamp glowing at nighttime. These frogs would come attracted by the light, beep, 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 you know, like. So I had a gallon of alcohol, which I carried for medicinal purposes. And so we'd ball up some cotton balls and dip them in alcohol and throw it out there. And after a while, we had a lot of drunk frogs sitting around. That was our entertainment. So that only happened a couple of times. But then there was an animal a couple of times. They had stray cattle out there, too. And that kind of excited us one night, hear all this noise, what's happening? And we couldn't see it, but it found out it was just some cattle was moving around and wanted to know what we were doing out there. So that was not a bad experience, but, you know, something to do.
I got to say, that's a first. I've never had a veteran tell me about drunken frogs before, so you learn something every day. And you're able to laugh about all this now, and I can tell that the tone of all your memories, you're clearly thankful to still be going strong at age 100, thankful that you came home. But at the time, I have to imagine that this was tense. This had to be scary at times. Is there a moment maybe that you look back on and you say, you know, that was probably my closest call. It really could have been my number in that circumstance?
Not really. We, even on the patrol, they'd always stick the corpsman right at the back end of the line of the patrol. And I always had to watch over my shoulder because that's what the JAS would do. They would be in these round holes. They'd just stand there and wait for the troops to go by and pop up and shoot them, you know. And that's what I was always afraid of. But it didn't happen. It did happen several times that I've heard of but not know of.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories out there. And my grandfather was in the medical corps in Europe, got a Silver Star, and he had the Red Cross on his helmet. And there were different times where he was told, well, they're actually shooting at you if they had that Red Cross, even though they weren't supposed to. And I've heard stories of some of the Marine Corps battles, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, where corpsmen were specifically targeted because the Japanese knew that would increase the casualties.
I don't know. Later on in the campaign in the Pacific, after Guadalcanal, they learned real quick at Guadalcanal, don't put a Red Cross on your shoulder because you were a target right then. And so the corpsman never put it on. In fact, we didn't carry it. Any time I went out, patrol duty or anything, no Red Cross. And so that was the extent of anything happening to me. I was never in danger as far as I can remember because I wasn't shot at.
Other than the time, you know, washing machine Charlie came by and dropped bombs, or the cannon fire when you're coming into Guam, or the sniper when you're, I mean, you say you weren't shot at, but most of us haven't experienced those things you just told us.
No, there's only one time I remember that there was a lot of shooting, but I was staying pretty low at the time, and that was when I was on Bougainville. And we were close to the beach, and there was snipers that come through once in a while. And we were always on guard at nighttime, because that's when the Japs would try to locate us and fire on us. And that's all I remember, seeing tracers, you know, nothing really happened. In fact, there's one time we were sent over to another beach, our whole company. They told us to dig in along the beach. They were expecting boatloads of Japanese to come in for an invasion. So we spent all night long watching the water, and nothing ever happened. But that was kind of an exciting place. I didn't sleep much that night.
Well, you answered my question there about whether you were able to sleep. And so you were still out there in the Pacific when Japan eventually surrendered?
Yeah, in fact, that was after I came home from the Pacific from the Marines.
Okay.
On Guam, I got my orders. It was 26 months I'd been out there then. And so I got my orders to go back to the States. I did my tour of duty in the Pacific. I'm darn lucky I got it then because my company were starting to pack up. They had orders for the next invasion. And they packed up, and I found out later, it was all 3rd Marine Division and a couple other Marine Divisions that went into Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. So they had a pretty rough time from then on. And I missed that. But from there, I went back to Pearl. And then I caught another ship and went back into Mare Island. And I got orders to meet with another company at in San Diego, Coronado Island. We had I forget the name of the ships were down there, but they were all Marine ships. Like it was an LST I was assigned to. I was the only medical personnel on that ship. But after I landed in Mare Island, and they gave me orders to appear to the fleet down in San Diego, the amphibious fleet is down below. But that was after I had given 2 weeks leave after we landed in Mare Island, sent me on a train down to my home, to L.A., and I spent 2 weeks spending a lot of money that I wanted to do something after I've been in the islands all that time. Yeah. But anyway, that was, I stayed with Mom and Dad was still overseas then. Then I had to go down to the amphibious training base. That was it. Okay. And caught this LSM. They needed a corpsman because the corpsman had, something happened, he had tour duty, and he had left. So they needed a corpsman right away because they were leaving the next morning. So that night I had to take my sea bag and everything. That was right after I had my vacation. That night I loaded aboard the LST. The skipper, which was a JG lieutenant, he had another lieutenant with him, which was a navigator. They introduced me to the crew, which was a crew of 10 or 12 men, something like that. And we loaded aboard. They gave me a stateroom. An LSM is like an LST. It's a tanker where they have a deck all the way back. They have the big doors that open to the ocean at the bow. And on both sides is where they have the compartments for personnel on either side. And I had my room was right next to my first aid station. And that's where I set up my clinic right there. But they introduced me that night, and we went in, packed up, unpacked, and got ready. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we shoved off. That was really quick. So we went from there. I never was exactly sure what that ship was used for, but it was mainly, we took a lot of supplies out to, we stopped in Pearl, and we stayed there for, two or three days, and loaded up some more supplies. And from there, we went out to Marcus Island. I don't know if you ever heard of Marcus Island, which was close to Japan. And we unloaded supplies out there. And I met a world-famous World War boxer, Jim Braddock. I met Jim Braddock out there. He had a crew of Americans, and they were doing loading, that was an unloading crew, that's what they were. And some guy said, "That's Jim Braddock out there." I said, "What? Okay, I knew of him." So I got his autograph, went over and got his autograph. But that was the extent of what we actually did. After that, we was heading back, I guess back to Pearl. We got news that the Japanese had surrendered. We were out in the middle of the Pacific, and I think we went down to Eniwetok. I think it was Eniwetok. We went in there, went into the bay in there, and that night, you never saw so many fireworks in your life. They told us, be careful, there's going to be stuff dropping around, you know. But nothing happened. So from there, we went to Pearl, and that's what was, and I was, went ashore. I was discharged from that boat, that ship. The LSNs were pretty nice. They were a nice ship, but they were, I don't know if you know, an LST is about two-thirds longer than that, just a bigger ship in contrast. But I got off from there at Pearl, and I spent a few days from there, and I caught another ship, and we went to San Diego, and I got discharged there.
When you mentioned Jim Braddock, I'm sure you've seen the movie they made about him, right? Cinderella Man with Russell Crowe. Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that.
Well, you'll have to see that. It's a pretty good film. I think it won some awards. Cinderella Man, it's called. So when you get home, I mean, here you've spent the last 4 years in the military. You've seen half the world. You've seen all these things. Was it hard to get on with life, or was that an easy transition for you?
Actually, I was glad to get out of the service. I had enough of militarization, do this or do that, shut up and move and don't cry and shut up, you know. Yeah. And I had a lot of friends in the service, and in fact, a couple of years, I heard from one guy, especially which was a Marine, and he went back to Oregon, to Portland. He lived in Portland, and I heard from him for a while, and he told me he went to Iwo Jima. In fact, after I left. When Guam was getting, packing up, they packed up and joined a couple other divisions and went back there. And I forgot to mention that when I was moving around after Guam and after I got that LSM, I contacted him through mail, and I found out that he had a pretty rough time on Iwo Jima, but he lived through it, and he told me about what happened. You know, they lost a lot of Marines. They were one of the worst battles in the Marines ever had. Something like 6,000, I think.
Yeah, 6,800 killed and close to 20,000 wounded. And I was going to ask you about that, because you made it clear if your time wasn't up, if it wasn't your time to come back to the States, you would have been there too. Were there some guys that you knew that ended up getting wounded or killed there?
No, because we didn't stop on the island. I knew my outfit was still on Guam. They were setting up a permanent camp for the Marines there. But I didn't know anything about what happened at Iwo Jima until he told me about it. And that was after we got to see. He came down and visited me one time, too, from Portland.
You also mentioning some of these famous people you met along the way, like the boxer Jim Braddock and so many of the celebrities of that era, the movie stars, the athletes, they were all in the service somewhere. But you also got to see one of the most famous aces of all time. You saw Dick Bong's P-38 flying away?
That's what I was told, but yeah. I never saw him. But there was several P-38s that flew out of the after they took it over from the Japs. And that's all I know about it. I read about it and I heard about it, that they were flying, and I thought, well, I'm sure Bong was one of those planes. In fact, he was in a group of that group that later on shot down this famous Japanese general. There was a group of P-38s that they found out after they had cracked the Japanese code, they found out that this general and his plane, it was a... I've seen gun camera pictorials of that.
Admiral Yamamoto.
Yamamoto, that's the one.
I'm also wondering, since you told us your story about where you were on VJ Day and the fireworks and all the party, and I don't know the answer to this, do you think those atomic bombs and the way they curtailed the war made a difference in whether or not you lived or died? Would you have been sent to that invasion of Japan?
I think without a doubt. Without a doubt, because as terrible and horrible as those two bombs were, they stopped all hostilities, anything like that, which is, if it hadn't happened, somebody had to go into Japan, and that would be a huge undertaking. It would be all the Army and Navy and Marines that they could get to take over that island, because they were preparing for us to go in there. You know, close to that, Okinawa had a very rough time because that was the South Island to go into Japan. We had already taken that. And I had a friend that came back from that, and he was half nuts when he came back because it was a lot of cave fighting, and that's where he didn't get hit, but... He was kind of a neurotic after that, but yes, I'm sure I would have been. I would have to stay in after the war, but my tour of duty was what they called a kiddie car cruise at 17 till the end of hostilities. That's what I was enlisted for. So at the end of the war, I was a free man. That's why after Guam, I was sent back to the States to be discharged, because my tour of duty was over. But I'm here because of two bombs.
That is something I wanted to ask you about, but it's time for our final break. We'll get Bill's perspective on the atomic bomb when we come back. Also, his honor flight experience and his artwork, including the space shuttle painting of his that's in the Smithsonian. You can find a video of Bill and that particular work online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with 100-year-old Bill DeGeneres of Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Born in Louisiana, raised in Southern California, but in the Pacific with the Marines as a Navy corpsman when World War II came to an end. And you heard Bill say just before we left off that he's here today, and so many of his fellow World War II veterans feel the same way, because President Truman made the decision to drop nuclear bombs on Japan, avoiding what would have been a far more catastrophic and deadly invasion of Japan.
I'm here because of two bombs. I don't thank the bombs. I mean, you know, that's a terrible thing. It's only one thing that it did, and that stopped the war.
Well, we wouldn't have this conversation otherwise, and we also wouldn't have some amazing artwork that you've produced in over all these decades since then. And I know you worked a few jobs, you went to college, you met your wife, but technical illustration, a lot of people wouldn't even know what that means. It kind of became your life's work. What are some of the pieces or drawings that you came up with, paintings, that give you the most pride?
Well, technical illustration, like I learned it, is taking engineering blueprints and converting them into two-dimensional or three-dimensional illustrations from the blueprint, so that it could be printed and labeled for use as parts illustration for catalogs for mechanics or other people or engineers want to see what the product looks like and how to take it out of that, like part of an engine or part of an air conditioning system or any systems in an aircraft that comes apart had to be labeled and put into a catalog. And that's what we did. I learned to do that. Right down to the nuts and bolts, label the nuts and bolts, any part. And they wanted, if it had to be serviced, we had to have an illustration of. At Brown, it was Bob Brown Illustration Company that I worked for. That's where I got my training. And I stayed there for over a year. And I got more money after a while from that. And that's when I went into more illustration and color and painting illustration with this engineer. Because when I first went to System Development Corporation, they needed drawings of the coastline of California, of different installations. Well, they had Nike Hercules installations all up and down the coast at the time. So they needed pictures of the illustration of where there was anti-aircraft deal, because System Development Corporation was a company that was making illustrated and movable, like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. They made moving illustrations of incoming aircraft and bombing by foreigners that they thought would be the Russians at the time. So we did a lot of illustration of big catalogs of complete invasions of the United States of all over for NASA.
that's a story all on its own. That's a surreal thought to have to put onto paper the way you did. And I'm going to put up some photos, if it's okay, at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see some of your artistic talent. What's the story behind this painting that's still at the Smithsonian?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to show it to you. It's of the first space shuttle. Space shuttle taking off into space. I was working with this scientist, Bob Salkill, Robert Salkill. He was developing new types of exotic propulsion systems for spacecraft. And the first one would go on the space shuttle, which was developed with the propulsion system on the aircraft for taking off and going into space. And that was later, they dropped that and just used that for coming back to Earth, for retroing back into Earth. So the painting that he wanted to see was of the space shuttle taking off, shooting out the flames at the back, heading off into space from the Earth. And that's what I did in color. It's all three-dimensional.
How long did that take you?
Oh, between a couple of drawings, two or three drawings, preliminaries, several. And he lived in Sacramento at the time, so I would get a rental car and drive up to see him, and with new illustrations, and in between times he was going back and forth to other places. I don't know what he would do. I'd take him these illustrations from the blueprints and from the preliminary drawings that he had made with other engineers. So from that I developed what they wanted to see. And this is a space shuttle of the space shuttle taking off, heading towards us out to outer space.
You didn't get to see that at the Smithsonian when you went on the honor flight, did you?
No, I did not get to see it. It was somewhere at the Smithsonian, somewhere.
Didn't have time to dig through all their collection. But speaking of the honor flight, I mean, this is so many years after the war that you end up going to Washington, D.C., 70 years after you were there with the Marines throughout the Pacific. What was that experience like for you? What were the parts of that that stood out for you?
It was so quick and fast. Everything was great to see. I mean, to go see the Smithsonian and see the different things that they had, several different aircraft. In fact, they had one of the spacecraft that they shot off around the Earth, some from first modules, what they call, that type of thing. It was so great to see it. And they had models of ships and things like that. It was just great to see. It was so quick to go. I wanted to spend a week there, but we just couldn't do it, you know.
Well, I do want to ask you specifically about a couple other things you saw there, and thanks for so much of your time here. The Marine Corps Memorial, and that's where that quote that I mentioned earlier is etched. Admiral Nimitz, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. And I'm thinking, you saw that firsthand, and you cared for some of these wounded Marines who had things you'd never seen before. You talked about identifying bodies by their teeth, that they were in that kind of condition. When you saw that Marine Corps Memorial with that quote on it and thinking about everything it represents, what was that moment like for you?
You're talking about the memorial for Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. It broke me up. Just brought back, pardon me.
It's a powerful place.
That was a highlight of my trip there, to see that. That's really something. I still don't know his name. Somebody told me that one of the corpsmen who's on there was in my graduating class from the Corps School. I'd like to double check that. I've got a list somewhere in my old stuff of my Corps School graduating class. Uh-huh. I've got a list of all of the people in that. I'd like to double check that. Get the name of the corpsman on there. It's not a great deal, but it's something that I would think. I knew that guy. He was in my company, you know, because that's quite a thing to see.
And we know that the emotions are real and that the lives were real, and 406,000 American lives were the cost of World War II, not to mention so many wounded physically and otherwise. You mentioned a friend who came back all broken up. I know it wasn't easy for your brother as a fighter pilot in Europe. When you went to that World War II memorial, here, a war that you and your brother and your father all served in. And there's that wall of gold stars there representing those 406,000 Americans. Were there some thoughts that went through your mind or reflections while you were looking at that?
Oh, you think about, you know, think about the things that you saw and happened on all the way from New Zealand through the Solomons, all the way into the Marianas and some of the atolls, and a ship being blown up. And I saw a few aircraft shot down, things like that. Those things go through your mind, and, you know, you're so glad nothing happened to you, but you're so sad about the other Marines and the friends that you lost. You know, they'll always be gone. I still have a lot of tender thoughts about Marines, the Marines I knew. They were a bunch of good guys.
Well, and you shared the name of one of them who was killed on Guam, not too far away from where you were, Herb Clark. Have you ever thought, well, maybe let me ask you this. Can you tell us what kind of guy he was? Like, what he was like?
He was a big guy. He was about, I guess, 6'2", and a very happy person, very intelligent guy. And he was married before he went out overseas. He had a beautiful wife. Of course, I met her later. And we played pinochle together. We talked a lot of times. And it was just a type of a good friendship. He was went back up to Auckland from Pukekohe, and he was in the same load, went up there, and everybody disappeared when they got into Auckland. And he'd tell me about some of the nice times he had, met some nice girls. It was kind of fun. You know, he wasn't a philanderer or anything like that. Very personable guy. I really liked him, and he used to tell me about his home life and what he was going to do after the war. He wanted to go back to college. I don't know what he was going to do. And he'd tell me about his wife and family there. His family was well-to-do, and his wife's family well-to-do. And, of course, I saw their place in Beverly Hills when I was there. And the people were there. They were all super nice people, really, really good. And I'll always remember him for being just a nice guy.
Well, one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that helps us understand the price that's been paid for our freedom. I know 100 years is a lot to look back over, but when you think about that, the 100 years you've spent on the planet, is there something that you look back on and you'd say that's what I'm most proud of, or that's what I'm most thankful for?
Well, I'm proud to have served my country. Number one, I did what I can. Nothing memorial happened to me other than I served my time, and it was with honor. I served two stints in the military. After my time during World War II, I was going to college, and I joined the Naval Reserve again while I was with Santa Monica City College, and I served 2 years of that. And during the 2 years, up came the Korean War. And I was called back into duty 1950 to 1951, and I spent my time at the dental clinic at the Marine Corps while I was there. So I finally got back into dentistry. But that was an enjoyable time. It was nice. I was a first-class petty officer. And I had the same privilege duty in the Marine Corps when rank has its privilege. And I was in the same rank privilege as a, I guess, sergeant major. So we had our own mess hall and go in and have linen on the tables and recruits serving you. It was wonderful. Yeah. I had a good time there.
Just one more question. And if there's anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know, feel free, whether it's about the military or your artwork or anything else. But I asked you to look back over 100 years and what you're most proud of. Let me ask you to look forward a little bit too, because you don't seem to be slowing down too much. People can hear how sharp you are. Is there something that you haven't done in these 100 years that you're still hoping to do, that you're looking forward to and say, hey, maybe someday I'll get to do XYZ?
I'd love to go see the Smithsonian Institution. Mm-hmm. I'd be wonderful. Maybe I could run across by painting there. I don't know. Yeah. But if not, I'd like to spend a few days and go through there and have a guide to show me different things that I know are there. And and that, you know, the aircraft, the history and things that are in there from way back before World War One. It's a marvelous institution. And I still get the Smithsonian Institution magazine. I get that every month. And there's some great stories in there. Oh, something I look forward to.
Well, maybe if we reach out to them, they can locate your masterpiece there and make sure it's ready for you when you get there. Was there anything else that you wanted to include that I didn't bring up?
No. Well, I'm 100 years old now, and I'm looking forward to much more than I have right now. I am in halfway decent shape. I don't walk as well as I used to. I have to have a cane, and I don't suffer any illnesses. Other than that, I'm living day to day. I was living in Oakhurst in a mobile home and by myself, and I had a lot of friends around me then, but it was becoming a pretty lonely existence since I had lost my wife a few years ago. And my son was always asking me, he says, come up when you want to. And I did visit him one time a couple, 3 years ago, and I liked it up here. And so he says, anytime you want, Dad, come on up. And I sit permanently. So that's what I've done. And it's turned out very well for me. They look out for me like I'm a star. They really treat me nicely. I would still like to be back in Oakhurst. I enjoyed that. But that's a no-no. I can't do that.
I guess I do have to ask you what your secret is, because like we talked, you're 100 years old and everything I just said. So how do you do that? What's the secret? What advice do you have for someone else who wants to be you?
Question 100 times and there's probably 100 answers, you know. Moderation, for one thing, is I think. Don't overdo things. Get plenty of sleep. Have fun. If you're single, have a girlfriends or boyfriends, and enjoy the opposite sex. Be moderation. Don't be a jerk. You know, just enjoy life in as nice a way as possible. What else can you say?
Bill DeGeneres, 100 years old. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Bill at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And the honor flight that he took was from California's Central Valley back in 2016. There's another one of those flights this coming week. So if that's where you live, welcome home 74 veterans on the 28th Central Valley Honor Flight on Wednesday, April 17th at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. Wherever you're listening to Hometown Heroes today, I'm Paul Leffler saying thank you for that, and I hope you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.